Patrick Phelps is this week's After Dinner speaker from Minerals West Coast. He's on the line from somewhere west of the Alps. Kia ora, Patrick. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian. Good evening.
Is it raining?
Depends on one's definition of rain, but yeah, the tar feels wet outside, that's for
right.
sure.
Okay, so that means it's not raining. by West Coast standards, it's not raining, but everywhere else it would be at least a seriously heavy drizzle.
Yeah, I'll be walking home, but I don't think I probably should have brought my raincoat with the benefit of hindsight, but never mind.
Yeah, it's not so bad when you've got your raincoat to walk, haven't got your raincoat to walk home, I find, because you can always dry off and get in the shower if you're getting cold on the way home. It's walking into work without the raincoat when it rains. It's really bad, eh?
Yeah, that'd be fair enough.
Patrick, you want to talk about you want to do, in your words, some myth-busting. And you're talking about the promise of better employment opportunities on the West Coast if you went, say, if you didn't have mining, you could go into tourism or something like that. And that would be a much better way of, a more environmentally sustainable way of earning a living. But you reckon not so lucrative if you're the person doing the working in that sector, right?
Yeah, correct. And I still don't know that it's actually that much better for the environment when you look right down into it. But just first and foremost, sort of looking at the economics, I guess, you know, regional parts of the country, but particularly I'd say the West Coast would be the epitome of this, that have always made a living off the land with a small population, whether that be through, say, mining or extraction of timber and things like that. As those industries have become less palatable for society, incidentally, those areas have got quite a high scenic value. So the suggestion has always been that people should, I don't know, put down their chainsaws or get out of their bulldozers or whatever you'd like to say and just sell the scenery to people who visit. But the economics of that just really don't stack up. And if I sort of, the last downturn that I can really remember in mining probably would have been about 10 years ago, Pike River, Solid Energy winding down, and then I guess Oceana Gold pulling out of the West Coast as well. But what happened after that was not that all the miners became, I don't know, people who cleaned rooms or served coffee. Most of them just took off to Australia or elsewhere. And that, I think, will be what happens. If you followed some people's argument to the extreme, most notably, I think I sent through in our notes, the notes that I'd sent through to you, the comments of the Conservation Minister in 2017 when the government announced its intention to put an end to mining on conservation land, that tourism was now more economically beneficial, which again I would say is debatable, and that we had to protect the things that bring tourists here. But that just doesn't stack up.
She's right, however, or was right, because she's not the conservation minister now, when she said that there are more jobs directly in tourism than mining now on the coast. That's correct, isn't it?
That does depend on how you define tourism, and that can be anything as simple as someone making a credit card payment if they reside from more than 40 kilometres away. I mean, a good example of that, one of the hotels in Hokitika is usually booked out through winter when the tourism season is pretty much as dead as it is for the whole year because it's booked out with people doing maintenance work at the dairy factory, but that actually gets credited into tourism's ledger if the people are coming from out of town. But back to your original point around the job numbers, if you were to, say, take accommodation and food services as being an industry that's fairly well associated with tourism, yeah, even now with the absence of international visitors, it's the largest employer on the West Coast in terms of job numbers, but that is just one economic metric. Job numbers are important, but they're not the only economic metric.
So where's mining in that in terms of full-time equivalents?
Mining is 10th, but funnily enough, even though mining employs less than a third of the number of people as accommodation and food services, I think, I'll just have a quick think, it was about $39 million or thereabouts were paid out in wages in the accommodation and food services sector, but the best part of $47 million paid out in the mining industry. So even with a third of the jobs, it paid out about $8 million more in wages, and its overall contribution to GDP is much higher. It's the third largest source, about 8.5%, and the biggest is agriculture, forestry and fishing at about 13% or thereabouts, and accommodation and food services is quite a way down that list. And this is the argument that I would make, is that job for job, mining pays the highest wage out of all of the other industries on the coast, about $8,000 a year. Accommodation and food service about $22,000, and the average is about $42,000, I think. So mining's almost double that, and accommodation and food service is almost half, which I was never too good at maths at school, but every job that you bring into the system below the average, you lower the average. Every job you bring in above the average is above the average. Now, talking like this sort of gives the impression that we can decide how many jobs there are in any one sector, and that's not possible in a market economy. But if you are to try and pass regulation and use these things as justification for doing one thing or the other, the argument for, purely through an economic lens, the argument for inhibiting mining and stimulating tourism doesn't really stack up in that respect.
Of course, there is another argument going on within the tourism sector, and it's been partly prompted by what's happened over the last year or two with COVID-19, about whether our business model for tourism is fit for purpose, and that maybe we should be going much more upmarket, and then maybe we wouldn't be. That at the moment, the business model is reliant on a lot of cheap labour, and your figures and tend to bear that out. I mean, an average for the tourism sector, this is on the West Coast, right? Of $22,310 is, well, that's extraordinarily low, actually. I mean, that does tell me just how poorly paid some New Zealanders are for working, and that's for a year, right?
Well, part of that will be because it's seasonal, right? So those people may not have worked every month of the year, but that would really only prove my point, because you can't really get away from that seasonal aspect of it. People only like travelling in the summer. Now, you can spend a heck of a lot of money on marketing if you choose, but I'd rather you didn't take that out of my pocket, because I've got other things I'd rather spend my money on. And we end up with, I guess this is one of the other things with tourism, is we've ended up in a situation where there is a significant amount of corporate welfare which costs the taxpayer but heavily benefits a far smaller number of people, you know, whether it might be something like the America's Cup or simply the fact that Tourism New Zealand, which is a government-funded agency, gets over $100 million a year to put towards promoting New Zealand overseas as a tourism destination. And I presume recently that must be some of the money that was diverted to that ungodly jingle, Do Something New New Zealand, that unfortunately I hear on the radio from time to time.
You won't hear it on our station.
No, fortunately not. So anyway.
Another reason to listen to RNZ National, even if you're a coaster.
Exactly. So, but if you look at they laud it as a $40 billion industry, but if you look at the top three components of that $40 billion, there's about $12.4 billion is associated with retail. So apparently that's alcohol, food and beverage, fuel and automotive. Now that's going to be inherently low wage. The next biggest chunk is transport, which is about a quarter. Now, transport obviously a massive part of New Zealand's emissions. So if you're going to make an argument against coal mining on the basis of climate change, it's very hard, in my opinion, to make an argument for tourism, especially when you look at the fact that since 1990, our international transport emissions have actually doubled. Now, whether that's because of New Zealanders going out or coming in, I guess you only count it one way, but that doesn't really matter. And the next one after that is accommodation, food service, hospitality, and that sort of thing. So that's that's about three quarters of the industry. And then the next chunk after that's GST of
Patrick,
that $40 billion.
You wouldn't deny, however, that what you have on the West Coast in terms of beauty is astounding. I mean, the road between Franz Josef, and okay, this doesn't cover all, I mean, part of it isn't the coast, but there, I reckon the road between Franz Josef and Queenstown is one of the most scenic roads I've ever had the pleasure of driving on, both as a passenger in a bus, as in a driver in a car. It's extraordinary, this landscape. People do want to go and see it from all around the world. Maybe what we need to do is change the business model so we're not relying on cheap labour so much to make a profit here.
Yeah, well, look, I wouldn't deny that the scenery is fantastic. I mean, that's a huge part of the reason that I choose to live on the West Coast. And the problem is that we don't actually capture the financial value of that. Auckland, Queenstown and Christchurch get most of that money, because if you break it down at a regional level, the majority of the spending, about 55%, this is before COVID, by the way, so the most sort of current relevant numbers, obviously, with the last year or two being an outlier in the context of this conversation. But prior to COVID, there was about, out of every $100 that was spent by tourists or attributed to tourism, both international and domestic, $55 out of every 100 was spent in Auckland, Canterbury and Otago. And regions like Southland and the West Coast, that between, I guess, Fiordland National Park and a fair chunk of the West Coast, account for 40-45% of the conservation estate, were getting less than probably 4% of all of the tourism spending. So they, it's almost like if you go through, say, a nature reserve or an art gallery, you don't actually spend any money when you're looking at anything. You spend it in the cafe or the gift shop on the way in or the way out. And that's how you probably think of our main centres, with the large population centres and airports, but there's just not that much money gets spent here. So while the scenery is the draw card, it doesn't actually financially benefit the people living in these small communities that have to bear the brunt of this, you know, just millions and millions of people here. I mean, I'm looking at, I'm just working next to the supermarket in Hokitika, and the car park is delightfully empty. A year or two ago, that just wasn't the case. And that really doesn't benefit everyone who lives here. It disproportionately benefits a small number of people on the coast and a, you know, concentrated, I guess, population, like I said, in some of those main centres.
Patrick, I've got a question here. I think it's quite a good one from a texter.
Yeah, go on.
Would be interested what percentage of women are working in those high-paid mining jobs?
Oh, I know a few women who work in the mines. Not a massive number.
Yeah. So it's a small proportion?
I suppose so.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an area where mining could do a bit better, couldn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it could, like a lot of other industries. But, yeah, mining could do better on that front. I mean, the accommodation and food service job, I guess, disproportionately expects employ females as well. So whether they would need to answer for the low wages that are paid to women, I don't know. But primarily, the reason that mining pays more isn't because mining companies are particularly more generous or that food and hospitality employers are particularly frugal or stingy. I mean, I've done a couple of seasons down in Southwestern as a tour guide, and while I wouldn't boast about my wages down there, the people I worked for were some of the best bosses that I've ever had. But if the average productivity, or that is GDP per labour unit within the accommodation and food service sector, is only about $60,000 a year. So anyone working in that industry, and bear in mind labour is only one component, you've also got capital and stock and other things to go into productivity, they have to be paid within that amount. Whereas the average mining job being paid $83,000 a year is because the productivity is a couple of $100,000 due to the value of what is being produced. I mean, another economic shortcoming, I think, of the tourism industry, I'd sort of go back to that $40 billion that people attribute. $10 billion of that is imports that are sold to tourists. So we've bought those things and then just sold them for a small markup. Whereas if you've got a regional economy like the coast or any other part of the country where you are actually producing something from raw materials, either digging it out of the ground or growing it and then processing it and selling it, you're genuinely producing wealth that wasn't there before. But buying a beer for $5 and selling it for $5.50 is just not a way to get rich.
If we are, end up, and I think we will at some point, start paying a lot more money for globally for the carbon that we emit into the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels, then maybe there will be a much bigger market, because we won't be able to travel overseas unless we can develop air power, which doesn't rely on fossil fuels. I know they're working on it, but how quickly, I don't know.
Working on a lot of things, Brian.
Yes, they are working on a lot of things, Patrick. So we might have to stay at home. And then you might get a lot more New Zealanders travelling at Highway 6, because it's going to be the best game in town in terms of scenery, isn't it? And that's going to bring a lot more money to the coast, isn't it?
No, because the money doesn't get really spent here. You drive down the road and look at the scenery, and I don't know, you buy a coffee or a pie or something at the petrol station in Hokitika on your way through and then keep going. But even
well,
if
then
we
does
sold some, a lot,
somebody needs to use their imagination about developing businesses that give you a reason to stay.
And people are free to go ahead and do that, but no one has had the ability or the inclination to do that thus far. And even, I mean, the place that I worked down Southwestern was the highest of the high end. You know, per person, people were paying about $400 or $500 a night. And when I took a group of three or four people out on a trip, each person was paying about $150 to $200. So that was high end, but nonetheless, I would have been out of a staff of about 12, not including the owner-operator. The chef was a New Zealander, I was a New Zealander, the rest of the workforce were temporary backpackers, and about a third of the people working in the accommodation food service sector on the West Coast were people on working holiday visas. Now, I don't begrudge anyone that. I mean, I made some very good friends in my time down there, flew to Scotland, went to their wedding. You know, I've made a lot of good friends with backpackers over the years, but nonetheless, that's just the nature of the beast. So you can try and sell more coffees, but that just means you have to take on more labour units, unless you put the price of things up. And then that actually has a social impact as well, because if we start to pay more for our, say, coffees or even just our supermarket groceries or our fuel, that flows through the entire community, whereas the price of, say, coking coal on the export market is going through the roof at the moment, and that's having a massive benefit, particularly up in the Buller, but it's not increasing the cost of living for the locals. And I think that's another issue as well. I mean, you look at Queenstown being the epitome of it. The social impact is that you get asset inflation where you can basically rent a room out for one or two nights to a visitor at the price you might get from a working person for a week. So you end up with low wages but inflated asset values, and that's not good for a region either. So if that's what the coast would head towards, if it had an economy more like Queenstown's was pre-COVID, I don't think that's a very desirable situation either.
Patrick, it's always fascinating and always fun talking with you. Thanks so much for your time again.
Likewise, Brian. Thanks for your time.
That's Patrick Fouts from Minerals West Coast with his alternate view, well, his West Coast view, actually, on things to do with mining and alternatives to mining.